So hi everybody, welcome along Tuesday morning. And for those online, glad to know you're there.
You've got Mandy, Gail, Anuku, and Sabina online.
Fantastic. Good to know you're all there. Okay, so let's begin as we normally do. We'll do a meditation first of all, and this meditation is on taking refuge together. We'll say some prayers, and then I'll give you an overview of the class and we'll get into each part of it. So please just get comfortable in your seat. This means that your back is straight, your shoulders relaxed, and you feel at ease. And you can have your eyes open or closed, whichever suits you. And I want you to let your body breathe itself. And feeling the body breathe itself. Relax into your own awareness. And feeling relaxed, imagine the environment around you is full of rainbows and flowers falling through the air. And the ground itself is made of soft lapis lazuli. It's a deep blue flecked with gold. And in the space directly in front of you, there is a throne. And sitting on that throne is the Buddha, Shakyamuni. In front of him is the His Holiness, the Dalai Lama, Lama Zopa Rinpoche, and the teacher that you feel most drawn towards. And surrounding them are many other enlightened beings, teachers and deities, the bodhisattvas and so on. And surrounding you are all sentient beings, with your mother sitting beside you on your left and your father on your right. And your friends and family are behind you, and people you don't like or who don't like you, people you've had difficulties with, they're directly in front of you. And we're all facing the Buddha and His Holiness. And you think about how lucky you are to still be alive today. And every second there are more than 50 people dying. So we are still alive and we have the leisure and an opportunity to attain our own spiritual goal. But we need to act quickly. Things are not quite right. They don't exist as they seem to. And though this is the case, you do have a spiritual friend who's leading you in the safe direction of the three rare sublimates, the Buddha, His teachings and the community which are in front of you. So to make your offering of practice purely for the benefit of all sentient beings, do your best to see yourself clear as a deity, holding a vajra and bell while experiencing great bliss. And then in front of the Buddha and his spiritual community, join me in taking refuge and generating a mind of enlightenment. So we can do this by saying, I go for refuge until I am enlightened through the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened through the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened through the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. Now, from the heart of each enlightened being in front of you, lights and nectars stream down and dissolve into yourself and all living beings surrounding you. These purify the negative karmas and obstructions that hinder the spiritual path. They also increase your health, your lifespan, your virtues and dharma realizations. We are cleansed by wisdom and empowered by love. Recollect the four immeasurable thoughts. Desire to develop love, compassion, joy, and equanimity yourself. And to establish all beings in those four immeasurable states. And you join me in saying, may all sentient beings have happiness and its causes. May all sentient beings be free from suffering and its causes. May all sentient beings never be separated from the happiness that is without suffering. May all sentient beings abide in equanimity, free from the bias of attachment for friends and hatred for enemies. But from the heart of each enlightened being, lights and nectar stream down and dissolve into yourself and to all living beings surrounding you. These lights and nectars, they purify the negative karma and obstructions. They increase your health and lifespan, your virtues and your dharma realizations. Allow yourself to relax a little more. On your exhalation, breathe out a little longer. I think you're preparing yourself to gather the merit needed for your spiritual path. To invite the field for accumulating merit and they appear. And we say before them, reverently I prostrate with my body, speech and mind. I present clouds of every type of offering, actual and imagined. I declare all my negative actions accumulating since beginning this time and rejoice in the merit of all holy and ordinary beings. Please remain until the end of cyclic existence and turn the wheel of Dharma for living beings. I dedicate my own and others' merits to the great enlightenment. Now we've created some merit and we've purified the mind. So now we need to stop the appearances of the samsaric world and grasping that it is real. So we imagine that our body itself becomes the universe. And we offer this to the Buddhas and the enlightened beings in front of us. And we say, this ground, anointed with perfume, strewn with flowers, adorned with Mount Meru, four continents, the sun and the moon. I imagine this is a Buddha field of offering. May all living beings enjoy this pure land. Idam Guru Rakamandala Kamayataya Omni. We've released the offering, and the Buddha has accepted with joy, and he gazes down upon us. And we look up into his eyes. In the eyes of the Buddha, we find immense humility, kindness, and acceptance. Now, our teacher leaves the merit field and comes to rest above the crown of your head. He puts his hands together in the prayer mantra, and he makes up three petitions to this field of merit. He asks that inspiring blessings pour down upon you and all beings surrounding you. So each one of us may quickly stop all the perverse minds we have. So we may quickly generate pure minds, and all of our outer, inner, and super obstructions be pacified. In response to this petition, again, lights and nectar stream down from the Buddha and the merit field. All the perverse minds are stopped. All pure minds come to fruition. And all fears and obstructions vanish. And you recollect the meanings of renunciation, bodhicitta, and the correct view. Then, from the heart of the Buddha, infinite light rays emanate. They reach all environments throughout all space and are absorbed by all beings. And everything dissolves into light, which dissolves up into the merit field, which dissolves into the Buddha, which dissolves into your teacher who's at the crown of your head. The teacher takes on the appearance of the Buddha, diminishes in size, and enters through your crown. It descends down towards your heart. The heart and mind of the Buddha become one nature with your mind. Within that nature, you hear the sound of the mantra. And you recite it three times along with me. From your heart, rays of light fill the 10 directions of space, and every sentient being abiding within space is utterly transformed into the fully awakened state. You acknowledge that you've fulfilled your purpose and the purpose of others. Then the light begins to withdraw from the 10 directions of space and re-enters your heart. And you can hear sounds. And you can feel the body breathing itself. You know that you're sitting on a surface of some type, and the meditation you've been engaging in is one of imagination. Through the process of imagination, you've imprinted the mind with the potential to fully awaken for the benefit of others. You realize also this potential needs the assistance of an authentic teacher and your own efforts in studying and putting into practice what you study. So you breathe in deeply through your nostrils, and you exhale through your mouth, and let your eyes flutter open. And you move your body in whichever way you'd like to, so you once again feel fun, ease, and comfortable in the seat. Now, as you know, we've been studying the two truths. I've been using these three books here as the major source of the teaching, and of course, teachings I've also taken from Khyentse Rinpoche and Geshe Thachsen Tserin. Now, we've gone through three classes already. So last week we looked at the stages of realization of these two truths, and how this understanding or the realizations go through these different paths. The week before, we looked at emptiness and dependent origination. Once again, the practical relevance to us. But we began with looking at the two truths themselves, conventional truth and the ultimate truth. Now, conventional truth refers to our everyday understanding of things. It includes the existence of objects and phenomena. The conventional in truth, so we've got these two roots, conventional truth. Remember, we also had a conventional existence. We had three types of conventional. In terms of conventional, in terms of truth, means ignorance, which conceals ultimate reality. Represents a sort of cognitive error, which obscures the true nature of things. In other words, everything that's appearing to us is actually dependently arising. But that's not how it appears to us. It appears it's already there. That's the simplest way I can say. It's already established objectively, and we just get at it. That's not how it exists. That's how it looks to exist. Now, ultimate truth is referred to emptiness, and this emptiness is the lack of that falsity that's in the conventional truth. It shows you that, wow, what's appearing to be true is not, and there's another reality. It's always been there, the reality of emptiness, the ultimate truth. And these ultimate truths are seen from the perspective of a person who's actually meditative equipoise. So it doesn't appear to us with our eyes open just like this. Right? The conventional truth appears. You see, if that conventional truth, which is appearing, actually inherently exists, you've sort of got to break it down intellectually in your mind and see if it's there. Of course, it's not there. So an ultimate truth is referring to your mental senses, not to your vision, your taste, your touch, anything like that. It's just, you can't apprehend it that way. You have to use your ability to think, to cognize. And when you do the thinking process, there's two stages. One where it's just still an idea to you, and then you break through the idea and see it as it is. And that's what we sort of talked about last week with the stages and paths. Now, there are different presentations of what is a conventional truth and what's an ultimate truth. So we're going to begin to talk to you about that today. And this is a subject that comes under a thing called tenets, which is just conclusions established through reasoning. What we talk about today are Hinayana tenet systems and what's the relevance to us. Now, the two types of system are Hinayana tenet systems and a Mahayana tenet systems. These Hinayana tenet systems are focused on the self of the person. So we all have a sense of self. It actually conventionally exists. We misapprehend it to have some sort of ultimate existence. And most people are just concerned with themselves, for instance. So these systems here deal with that. The person is primarily concerned with themselves, their own suffering, and they wish to put an end to it. And here we've got these two schools that we'll talk about as we go through. One's called Sautrantika, one's called Vaibhashika, and the other's called Sautrantika. Vaibhashika also has the name called Great Exposition, and Sautrantika just means sutra. I'll just, there's an overview here, then we'll come back into it. Now, as we go through this, I want to sort of go through each of these two systems and show you or explain to you what's fundamental to each one, what the differences are, in terms of persons in particular, and then how they study this phenomenon. So we begin with a quote by the Buddha, and he says, "My teaching has two modes, advice and tenets. And to the children, I give advice, and to the yogis, I give tenets." So what this is meaning is that the teachings of the Buddha meet us where we are. It's as if we were in an art class. Some of us were adults and some of us were children. To all the children, the teacher gives crayons and paper. As the adults, he might give much better pens and compasses and paintbrushes for even, because we're older. We've already gone past the crayon stage. So we get different instruments to create our artwork. But the children, they get the crayons. To become an adult, to get the brush, you have to go through the stage of crayons. So in summary, these teachings of the Buddha are sort of tailored to meet the needs of a beginner or the needs of an advanced student. We're going to be looking at the tools of the advanced student today, whether we're children or yogis, we're going to have a look. We begin by looking at this phenomena called tenets. And of course, this is a term that's probably not really familiar to us. So we go like, what are those things? What are you talking about? What they actually are is philosophical conclusions or conclusions that have come about through thinking about something. So yeah, when we think about things, we draw a conclusion. It might be whether we should go shopping today or later on. These types of reasonings have to do with philosophy, how things exist, what exists, and how they exist. So, like I said, they are called conclusions established through reasoning. And this reasoning is to help us illuminate or understand what we're meant to do to get to where we want to be. Studying these different systems fosters a deeper understanding of reality. It helps dismantle wrong ideas. And it's meant to cultivate wisdom, intelligence, to help us get on in the world and basically put an end to our suffering. When we engage in these systems of thought, what happens is you get to refine your view, meaning you get to refine your understanding. You start off like the simple understanding of kids with crayons, and then you get right up to the whole theory of art, how it works, what perspective is it, all that sort of thing. So I'm going to start off with an analogy to sort of show you how this works. So I use the education system. So when we first come into school, like early childhood, I mean, you're sort of brought in, you do a lot of sleeping at school, you might draw crayons. You don't do a lot of study, do you? I guess it's basically your parents drop you off at that school and you're cared for and you do very simple things there. What is common there and every other school you'll go to is that it's a classroom and you have a teacher. So that's always going to stay the same. You go to primary school. Now you might start learning your ABCs. You'll end up in secondary and then you'll go on to tertiary education. It's a similar type of thing that happens with these tenet systems. We just begin, it's very simple. And the simplest is we just look at how things are right now. They're real. So we begin, that's the system. The first system is it's real. The second system goes on and says, yep, it's real again. But we've got different ideas now. It's not just like lying around, now you've got to do your ABCs, you learn mathematics. One and one is two, this sort of thing. You grow up and then suddenly, Chittamata system. So those first two, what we're talking about today, Vaibhashika and Sautrantika, or Great Exposition and Sutra, that's what we're talking about today. The real world, so they present it like this. What we'll talk about next week is how the other people talk about it. They say there is no real world, there's only mind. Very different presentation. The last guys come along in the middle way, they go, look, Both of you are a bit extreme here. It's neither just mind, it's not just physical. It's not really real, but it's not just made up by your mind either. So we have an explanation for it. And like I said, so you do have similarities going through this whole sort of thing. Just like in the education system, you'll be in a classroom, you'll always have a teacher, there'll be something to learn. The attendance systems, it's the same. So there are similarities, but then there's difference in explanation. So let's begin with this first school then. So this is presentation, a general presentation of what this attendance system is, how it works. It's just like I said, going to school. And we are sort of going to have a look at each of these schools. So what's interesting about this Vaibhashika system? So it's the earliest of the Buddhist schools, and it's the least subtle, meaning it's easiest. It doesn't go into a great, it's not all that hard, and many of the other schools just leave it behind. They do take one really interesting thing from it, which I'm going to show in the next slide. But everything else is basically disregarded. It's like, we've disregarded our knowledge of when we first got dropped off at that first school by our parents. It's the same with the Buddhist school, they just let it go. She goes, no, I'm at university now. I've forgotten all that stuff. I don't really need it. But you do need it when you're that little baby. So it's the earliest and least subtle of the Buddhist schools. It's primarily valued for its clear classification of phenomena. So in other words, it classes all the phenomena. So you look around, like if you look around and go, well, what are the phenomena? You go, what are, well, there's me, there's a person. Yeah, and there's everything else. And they take everything else and say, what about it, that everything else? Well, what are they and how do they exist? So they would say, well, there's some permanent phenomena and there's some impermanent phenomena. And of the impermanent phenomena, there are physical things, there are non-physical things, and there's a mixture of both. And so they break it all down like that. And what happens, all the other Buddhist systems go, that's a great idea. We're going to keep that. And then they move on. They just basically drop everything else the school's got to offer. The best thing the school has to offer is this system of classification. So this system presents like a blueprint or a plan that we can use to go through every other system of Buddhist thought. That's the most valuable thing the system has to offer. So I'll show you the system, the plan, and then we'll go into each room, so to speak. So if we're looking at the plan of a house, we go, every house has a plan, right? Well, as we go through the systems, each room you go into, the room is always the same, but what's in there is different. I think it's a simple way of looking at it. But like I said, they start like what exists. So this goes, every Buddhist school, you have to have, if you're asking how something exists, you need the what. Right, so we've got what. What exists? Well, the selfless. Now, when this remember, so we're going to be talking about four different schools of thought, and they've all got different ideas of what the selfless is. This school and the other one we'll be talking about today talk about the selfless nature of the person. That's where the selfless is about. Next week, the other two schools take this and then they go and the selfless nature of everything else too. But these guys don't. They just need the person. And so then the next category they have is what exists and what does not exist. So in relationship to the person, these guys say this is how a person does not exist. There is no permanent person. There's no person independent or not dependent upon their body and mind. And there's no person that exists as a single entity. Those are non-existents. They don't exist at all. So what does exist? Well, you go, well, a person, of course. But then you go, like, then how? And in the simplest expression they give, and all the other schools accept this, is the person is imputed. to the five aggregates or to the body and mind. So now we have something that does exist. The person does exist, another side got something, and the person does not exist. Then I ask this person who exists depends upon the body and the mind, is it permanent or is it impermanent? Is it a produced phenomenon or an unproduced phenomenon? And they'll go, well, there are phenomena that are not produced. And they give the examples, three examples. They say unproduced space, nirvana, and emptiness. These phenomena are unproduced. They do exist, but they're unproduced. They're permanent. This thing I call thing, that's another name at the school I give for anything produced, is just a thing. And what is it about that thing? It functions. So a person exists and they function. Is this true? Come on, is it true? We're here, aren't we? We all exist and we function. We can go up and go, but we're not permanent, we're not independent, we're not singular. No. We're a name put on the body and mind. Is that permanent? No. It's impermanent. So we go, okay, now the next thing about these impermanent or things, how many types of thing are there? They go, oh, well, we can put it down to three types of thing. Things that are physical, like the body. So we have a thing that is physical. Then we have another thing that's not physical. What's that? Consciousness. Then we've got these other things that are neither. They're a bit of both, you might say. And they're called abstract or non-compositional factors. What might those things be? I say, how about time? How about area? How about space? How about karma? How about the person? Right? There's lots of things that aren't physical and they're not purely mental either. And in fact, this abstract area has probably got the most of all. Of that abstract area, the most important are karma and the person. In terms of consciousness, this gets broken up again. There's all these ways that you can divide it up, but for our purposes, one simple way is called main mind and mental factors. The main minds are the six consciousnesses we have: visual consciousness, auditory consciousness, gustatory, kinesthetic, and so forth. Right. They're the five major ones, but then there's mental consciousness. And all these consciousnesses are made up of parts. So this we have the mental factors. Just this division. And form, of course, it could be color, could be sound, could be shape, could be taste. These all have their forms. So all the other schools have looked at this as this is the great idea. It's a great way of mapping everything that does exist, and then we can ask questions about how these things exist. So this is the most important thing you can take away from this system, I think. This is the way of categorizing phenomena. You know, we do the same, don't we? We might do it through biology. We do it through all our sciences. We categorize things like that. Okay, now the fundamental things now about the school, right? What's really important to them, the most important thing about their presentation I can impart to you, is that in terms of the ultimate truth, because remember here, all these things have still got to fit into ultimate truths and conventional truths. The ultimate truth of things are these, what they call partless particles. These are referring to the physical phenomena, meaning our body. And the momentary consciousness, these moments of consciousness. These two things are ultimately true. The smallest moment of our consciousness, this moment, is an ultimate truth. And the very smallest moment that makes up our body is an ultimate truth. So in Western terms, the smallest thing you can get down to, whether it be an atom or something smaller, that really exists. Because if it didn't, we wouldn't exist. There's something there. It's real. That smallest thing that's real is ultimately true. This is where Western science has been going for the last couple of 100 years, looking for the ultimate truth that, like God, right? God created something, must be there. That thing must ultimately exist. God's ultimate, this thing ultimately exists. Expression of God. I call it the God particle we heard some time ago, right? That term used. So these schools are saying, yeah, just like the ancient Greeks did in their atomic theory. There's something real there. Something real physically, something real mentally. That real thing is the ultimate truth. So then the next question arises, well, what's the conventional truth? And then is the things that those things make up. Like this, the body that you have, that's a conventional truth. It'll fall apart. But no matter how far it falls apart, the atoms that are going to remain is ultimately true. They don't fall apart. These really small things always maintain their sense of being. So if you take anything, the clock is, what's the clock? A conventional truth or an ultimate truth? Conventional truth. Why? It has parts, and all those parts are going to fall apart and come down to find the atoms. The atoms are true, they remain. You must have heard that story where the atoms just change form, everything disintegrates, but the energy stays, right? Energy just takes a different shape. That's what we're talking about here. Something does it, something goes away, something stays. What stays is ultimately true. The energy just changes the shape. Now you've got to have heard, even the atoms that made up Adolf Hitler still about. But they've just changed into taking new forms. So anything that can be broken down and changed, that's a conventional truth. But its ultimate foundation, those atoms, in terms of the physical things, they're ultimately true. They ultimately exist. It's the same with consciousness. It never really goes out of existence. It can change, but it always remains the smallest moment of consciousness. The consciousness and physical things at their smallest level are ultimately true. They're ultimate truths. And they show themselves up in the world like this and can be broken down. In fact, anything that can be broken down is a conventional truth. That's the most important, this is the most important presentation of how things exist. What's ultimately true, what's conventionally true.
Jan commented that partless particles can be seen as the particle collapses to a wave function according to quantum mechanics, which may also point to the ultimate truth using current thinking.
Yep, that's right. So that's right. Very similar types of presentation in the West, right? They're talking about real things here. Those phenomena really exist. My bachelor is saying, yep, they do. This is our presentation. Now, what's important about this presentation, like I said, is to actually look at the person. So you can go and say, so how does the person ultimately exist and how do they conventionally exist? So we know that if you, the body that's right here, we have all these types of thoughts and so forth. If you break all that down, we're just going to get these really, really small moments of mind or really, really small moments of physical phenomena. There's no person in there, is there? There's no self that can be found amongst all those little points. So that's the presentation of the selflessness of the person. The person exists when it all comes together, right? But there's no self found within it. There's no ultimately true self, is there? No. So the self is just a conventional truth. How? It's when it all comes together, we just call that phenomenon, the body and the mind, the shape of it. It's got awareness. That's the person. So it's imputed, designated upon these five aggregates that are changing, can all fall down. No real person in there. The aggregates aren't a person. The smallest moments of minds aren't persons. They don't ultimately exist as persons. The only thing that ultimately exists are these smallest moments. But what we do exist conventionally. That's what I'm saying. We conventionally exist. When all these things come together and form the shape of a body, and it is a body, and they're thinking, that is our con so the person conventionally exists. It's a conventional truth. How profound within these aggregates or these moments of mind, and is not the moments of mind or the physical form.
So even as Buddha, in the Buddha,
Oh,
as
back
Buddha
in,
explained,
yeah.
we refer to a person's imputed to the five aggregates.
That's right.
So,
That's right. But all the systems have that
yeah.
understanding, that definition. But what they mean by it is quite different. That's the thing. So the easiest thing to take away, and what's really workable here, is that there's no permanent person or soul amongst all this. Yeah. You should be able to pick that up pretty quickly, I think. So, well, the person conventionally existing is the name put onto this phenomena that's changing all the time. Right? But no matter how much it changes, at the very deepest level, there is something that's always there. If it weren't always there, if it weren't there, you'd be out of existence. You'd be out of, you know, wouldn't exist. But the things that do exist are these very small moments of mind, very small moments of matter. They ultimately true. There's the ultimate truth from the school's perspective. Everything else is a conventional truth. Now, this school, of course, just like every other school, you find there's stuff that the next schools are all going to accept, and other stuff they're going to go, no, we don't accept that. So what makes this school quite different is this idea of this ultimate truth, or these partless particles, partless moments. That's the big thing. Like, it's the most important thing. That's the thing that really differentiates themselves from every other school that follows. And just like Jan was saying, you know, you go right down, that's exactly where the Western's gone down to, this path. What's very important about this is the idea of the selflessness of the person. So when you look amongst all these parts and so on, there's no permanent person there. There's no person separate from the body and mind or from all these moments. There's no person in amongst all existing as one of those singular phenomena. There's only singular things there are the mind and the physical phenomena that make up the body. That's it. As we know, if you have the person, what we call a person, if they die or when they die or if they're killed, you look at it, then the body will disintegrate, won't it? It'll just disappear. Right? So there's no person there. But they're saying, okay, so yes, it all disappears, but it doesn't go completely out because of the atomic nature of the person. That remains. The force, you might say, or the atomic structure, the wave. All these sort of things that the West talks about. So the persons don't ultimately exist. People don't ultimately exist. They exist, like we said, Helen, conventionally. Now, persons are conventional truth. They don't ultimately exist. There's no soul or anything like that that can ultimately exist. The only things are these small moment, physical moments and small moments of mental consciousness. So I put up this picture of the sandcastle here because I think it's a great example, right? So we look at it, it looks like a sandcastle there, right? And it is, isn't there? But if you break it right down, what's actually there? Grains of sand. That's all it is. The whole thing's about it is grains of sand. And it's just like us. We're made up of grains too. It's really, really small moments. Put them all together, you get a person, put all the grains of sand together, you get a sandcastle. That's it. Now, the self, all the phenomena exist independently of the conceptual imputation and can perform the functions. So this means that, like I said, these really small moments, they're already there. They don't require a mind to know them. They're there. They've always existed. They're ultimately true. And they can perform functions. As they do, they come together and we end up with a body and we end up with this mind and then it falls apart again and then comes back together again. And like the sand, you could push the whole castle down, the grains are still there though. You can put them all up together and make a new castle. Now the self, like I said, so all these schools are presenting, there was, like I said before, the selfless. So what that's about is like they're telling you, like, this is the self that is not there. The self that is there, which we all agree upon, is the one that's imputed to the body and mind, or imputed to the aggregates. That self's there, that exists. It's like you said, hell, that convention exists. But they really focus on what does not exist. The self that you think exists doesn't. So here in the school, they're saying because the self is not permanent, but does exist, it has to be impermanent. That's right. And because it is not independent, it must be dependent. That's right. Right? And because it can't be singular, it must have parts. And that's all right, isn't it? It's exactly right, right? We are just like that. Yeah. That's how the self must exist. And this self that has parts is impermanent and is dependent. It's dependent upon the body and the mind, the five aggregates. So one of the aggregates is form, that's anything physical, our body, and the next four aggregates are all mind, and that's what the self, our self, depends upon. So because those things, the body and mind, are impermanent, the self is impermanent too. And it is, isn't it? We change, but we don't stay the same.
It tells us.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, old age tells us that too, right?
In
Yeah.
the Vaishika canon developed the definitions of the four mental aggregates.
Yes, you said it came out of that. Yes. Yeah. And every other school has accepted that and gone, yep, that's, we're fine with that. Yep. Yeah, we work within that. And then, yeah, but then of course there's slight changes and so forth. Like I said, so many things are kept the same, and some things are changed. But those changes make a big difference. Now, the people in this school, like I said, they're just like, really, it's before primary school. You just got there. Parents have dropped you off. So what they study and they practice is they look at the body, because that's the things, they look at the things that exist, the body and mind. And they try to become as familiar as they possibly can with what a body and mind is made up of and how it functions. This idea of the two truths, that anything that breaks apart is a conventional truth, and what remains is an ultimate truth. So through this study of their five aggregates and so forth, they practice understanding like impermanence, everything disintegrating. There's nothing to really hold on to. That the self is not the body, and it's not the mind. So it can't really be an owner of them. It can't possess them. It doesn't exist as a possessor, a real possessor, like the aggregates, like those final moments. It's not real like the atomic nature, the really smallest physical stuff. And it's not real like the really smallest mental stuff. It's not ultimately true. It's just a name. So can you see how wonderful that is to know that? Well, because for most of us, isn't it, we grasp at our body and the mind as if it's mine. As if we're an owner independent of the whole thing. Well, we don't exist like that. So that's really valuable. That should put a real end to this whole idea of attachment and loss. You know, we have this, like, from this perspective, we have a real body and a real mind, but there's no real person that owns them or possesses them. When we're insulted, you ask yourself, well, who's being insulted here? You just have to say, me. Right? You go, well, are you the body or the mind? You have to go, no. So who's being insulted? You're not a real thing, are you? You go, no, I'm not. Right? There's huge benefits, even in this smaller system. And these principles, they keep going right through. I mean, that this keeps going. These things are still true. And the realizations of it remain all the way through the different tenant systems. You always end up here, no, there's no real you there. That got reputed right back before primary school. When we first went to school with, these are the real things. These are the unreal things. The self is not real like these other things. Just tell
Just taking your example of being insulted, it's funny, isn't it? Like we get insulted like yesterday, but we still feel like we were insulted right now.
me.
But it was already yesterday, and the body was changed, the mind has changed, but we don't act like that, do we?
That's right. So we take a sense, a permanent sense of self, right, from yesterday to today. That's how it appears to us. Rosemary.
It's not just insulted, it's
Oh, yes,
Christ.
that's right. Anything. That's right. Yeah. So in terms of practical relevance, so this is, I find this quite, you should all find this quite interesting. So how's it interesting? One way, these guys teach you anything that does exist, if it conventionally exists, it can be broken down into parts. So a thought that exists, it conventionally exists, right? You can break it right down into parts, and what are you going to end up with? These really, really singular, smallest moments of thought. Then you can ask yourself, am I my thought? And go, no. You're not one of those really small moments. And those really, really small moments aren't the complete thought, they're a part of it. What's the point of holding on to these real thoughts? These thoughts that are not true, right? They're not ultimately true, because you can break them into parts. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's right. So there is a continuum of change, but because the process of change takes place, what you'll find is here, you're not the same. You're quite right, but you're not completely different either. So, see, you are imputed to this phenomena that's in constant change. But even behind the constant change, there are these things that don't stay the same, but there's something there that is constantly changing. And you say, well, we've got the really smallest moments of mind and the really smallest stuff of our body. And me is given to that. So whatever happens to those things happens to me. That's conventionally true. No, from this perspective, they do.
From this perspective,
Yeah.
okay,
So
I'm
here,
going to
so they say, yeah. So this is a realist school. Look, these things are real. So another word for real is inherent, or substantially existent. These phenomena have a real existence, a substantial existence, inherent. And from their perspective, these things, because they exist, they should be able to be found because they exist. So we're going to come to the next school, they're going to throw all this into the wind, basically. So great benefits from this is like detachment. You don't want to be attached to these phenomena. They're not you. You're not them. You're not a separate thing from them. This gratitude that when they all come together again, you're called a person and you exist. But also this reduction of self-centeredness. Remember, the self is just a name put onto it. It doesn't truly exist. It doesn't really exist. So a huge reduction there. And then you have this more balanced approach. This is the idea. This is recognizing that both mind and body are impermanent aggregates. So they're the aggregates of these really smallest parts. Encourages us to care for them without attachment. This perspective reduces stress about aging or loss and fosters a balanced approach to health and well-being. So, again, you can see we're not non-existent, right? We exist. It's just we're really looking here at how things exist. So the first map I showed you was this idea of these are the phenomena that exist. And now most of the Buddhist stuff is okay, how? So these schools really talk about how the phenomena exist, not whether they exist or not. That's covered really early in the piece with that map. So here, you know, we should take, okay, I'm not the body, I'm not my mind, I'm not my thoughts, I'm not my feelings. There's a whole thing that you're not. They call that's the selfless. You're not these things. What you are is a mere name put upon this phenomenon. That's your identity. It's just the name I. And it all functions, doesn't it? It still works, just because you're a name for another. It all works. And then it works.
So just to, I don't know, this might be a silly example, but like, let's just say we break a bone in our hand. It's like, you know, you are not a self who permanently has a broken bone, and yet you do have a broken bone, so you still care for your broken bone, and you still heal because it's changing and whatnot, but you don't have to identify in a fixed thing of I am this, like whether I'm insulted, whether I'm praised, whether I have a broken bone. You can loosen it up and care for yourself and grow.
Yeah, that's right. Let's start there. Yeah. So let's do a meditation, a quick meditation, and we'll go on to this next school and have a look at what they say. Please just be comfortable in your seats. Let your shoulders drop, straighten your back. And if you like, close your eyes and let the body breathe itself. We'll try to generate an altruistic intention for studying this tenet system. We're going to explore the Vaibhashika view of reality, where truth, conventional and ultimate, exists in two layers. One is the fleeting sensations that the body and mind experience. There is the phenomena called body and mind themselves. And then there are the timeless essences, these very smallest moments of physical things and mental things. So just allow yourself to have a thought or just deliberately think something. Okay, you've thought something. When you thought that thing, did it feel real to you? Or was it constructed? So this system, the Vaibhashika, teaches two truths. There are the atoms of experience, whether they be physical or mental. These are ultimate truths. And then there's the assembled concepts. They're the conventional. If you confuse them, suffering arises. If you can discern them, liberation unfolds. It's like staking a carpet for its threads. We cling to the holes and not the parts. If you trace the origin of a sound, is the music real or is it just vibrations? The vibrations are the ultimate. And the music is your mind's gift to yourself, the conventional truth. A wave of water will dissolve, leaving droplets when examined. So just feel your hand. Put your hand on your hand. What appears to you? Is it the hand or the atoms of the warmth, the atoms of pressure? The atoms persist, but the label can shift. If you look at a forest, what is the forest? It's a vast group of individual trees. These are the, it's like this, this is like the ultimate. The forest is a conventionality. You can recall a moment of joy. Was the moment real? Was it made of fleeting parts? So the parts are the ultimate, and the memory is painted by the mind. So if today you experience some sort of frustration, you can dissolve it into its atomic truths, its very small parts. And you can just rest in that, that knowledge. When you're focused on the parts, the whole disappears. Okay, now breathe in through your nostrils. Exhale. Let your eyes flutter open. Now we're going to come to this next school called the Savatantrika or the Sutra school. This school has a very different presentation than what we just heard. And I'll put up the different, how it's defined, and then break it down to say what it actually means. So the fundamentals of this are, there are specifically characterized phenomena. These are the ultimate truths. And these truths are capable of performing functions. So what is this? I'll give you an example of a specifically characterized phenomenon. Here's one here. It's called a clock. It's specifically characterized as a clock. This is the ultimate truth in the system, not the atoms that make it up, all the smallest parts. Because this can perform a function, it's ultimately true. Chair you're sitting on is an ultimate truth in the system. It performs a function. And so anything that performs a function is ultimately true. If it doesn't, it's a conventional truth. So it's like a sense that we did this and I was like, oh man, this really rocked. I couldn't get my head around this. Once you get to the vibe back to the middle way consequence and you come back to this, it's like a monstrous step back. It's like saying everything in the middle way consequence, which we're taught a conventional truth, these guys are saying they're ultimate truths. That's basically it. So anything can perform a function from this perspective is an ultimate truth. If it doesn't, it's a conventional truth. That's probably the simplest way of saying it. Yes. So think it's thoughts in the system are seen as permanent phenomena. If those thoughts perform functions. What you're thinking about may not be, but not perform any function whatsoever, but the thought of it performs a function. Yeah. So objects like pots, clocks, chairs, sounds, anything directly perceived by your senses are seen to be ultimately true. It's an ultimate truth. So a conventional truth in this aspect is like the forest. But now the trees perform functions, but forest is a made-up word. It's a conventional truth. And but the most important thing here is the how we apprehend the phenomena, how we get at them. So of course we get at them through our senses, right? The Vaibhashika was saying, like, you don't actually get at the atoms and so forth directly with your sense. You get at the objects themselves, don't you? But then you break them all down. Sorry, so these guys go like, you can break it right down to the atomic things, and just like Jan said, we can see, we can get at them. So those things are ultimately true. These guys have ultimate truths. They're the things that perform the functions. But the question is, how do you apprehend them? How do you know them? The previous school said directly. You can directly see the wave function or the atomic stuff. Right? These guys say, no, you don't. You don't see that. You don't get it directly. And if you think about this, so this is, we also, these guys, this is what these guys are saying is true, because we know this in modern science, right? You never actually get at the thing, you get at the mental representation of it. Like with colour, right? The colours aren't out there. They come up through your eyeball, they go up here. Your mind constructs the colour, but it looks like it's out there. But so these guys are saying your mind constructs it all, makes it up. You don't get at the things directly. It's like, you know, when you've heard that, when you hear, but they don't know me. And just like you said, they don't know me. You're right. They don't. What they do know is their conceptual construction of you, their idea of you, just like us. We never get the objects directly. We get them through our ideas, through our conceptual makeup. That's how we get at it. Even everything that we sense has to go through the mental consciousness. That's where it's all constructed. We make it up. Hear me?
A question from Julia. What if a certain behavior is performed based on untrue perceptions of self and the world?
Yeah. So what about it? Because I'm telling you, that's exactly what we're doing. We're doing that all the time. So here these guys are still saying, the function defines reality. If it functions, it's real. The concepts, they veil it, they hide it, they make it up. So I'll give you a nice metaphor or example. Have you ever seen those, when we were kids, you could get these picture books and you each page would have a little drawing on it. Then you hold it and you flip the pages and the whole thing would move. Right? Yeah, that's right. You get this look like it's moving, right? So each of those single moments like the ultimate truth. Then you put them together and you've got them all together, but then you do this flickering thing. That's also real too, what shows up to you, right? You get a real appearance. The pictures are real, and then it all seems to really move. So both of these things are real. They're both performing the functions. But one is like a composite, all the pages, and one is a single thing, the single page. When they all move, you get this reality. Where's the reality being made up? Back here. Your mind makes it all up. But there's no actual story going on out there, is there? It looks like it. Of course it does. But it's actually one page, next page. How movies are made. Each one is just a still. They run fast, and now it all looks like it's really happening. Where's the really happening taking place? Back in the terms of the viewer. It's not out there. So there's a big difference. The difference is how the senses work, our perception. That's where the sound traffic is really big. This is their major thing. They don't have any problem with partless particles and all that. They go, yeah, sure, no problem. We accept that's fine with us. It's how we're perceiving them. They say we don't perceive them directly. We don't actually perceive the atomic stuff directly, these really small ones. We make it up. We conceive their conceptions, ideas. And that's like for everything. And our science, our neuroscience will tell us that that's exactly right. That's what's going on. Yep, Debbie?
So according to the Sartantric position, is it kind of like a chair has the function of being sat on?
Yeah.
Whether it's a good chair or a nice chair, fancy chair, nice chair.
That's conventional truth. That's the conventional truth. That's right. We've made that up. That's the stuff we make up. All the qualities and stuff, we make all that up. That's conventionally true. It's not wrong. This is the conventional truth. It's conventionally true. It's not really true, though. It's real, but not really true. But,
sick.
yeah, that's right. No, we're not wrong. Yeah. So these guys are like that, right? So these guys really emphasize a valid perception and reasoning to distinguish the real phenomenon. So reasoning is a big part in this system. And it keeps on going too. As you'll see next week, and I've said before, some things are kept and some things are disagreed with. We've got like a sort of a build-up. Where they're different, they assert external objects, true existence, and these specifically characterized are ultimate truths. Like, so again, if it functions, it's an ultimate truth from these guys. Sometimes the language, that it's quite obtuse, because we're not philosophically trained people. This language is there for a particular reason. They're really trying to get as specifically things, defined as clearly as possible. But like I said, if you just look at ourselves as children learning about what the adults know, then we just use common language to make it sensible for ourselves. And, you know, if we want to take more interest in this type of topic, you go, okay, there are good reasons for using this type of language. So in terms of what this, if you use this as, like I said, this idea of the flip book is probably a really good way of doing it, or like a movie in frames. Right? So if you look at the movie in frames, right? No single frame is the movie, is it? Not one of them, right? But when it's all played, you've got a movie. Right? So no single moment of the body, of our experience, is us. Right? But as the moments get played, it's us. I mean, if you look at, you know, when we were 2 years old, right? You take a single moment of that, you go like, is that you? One moment of mine. And you probably go, yeah. We go, well, hang on a minute. Remember what we said before about these mind things? They're single moments. You're not that single moment. It's easy to forget this, right? Because we just come back to the way we've always been. You go, no, I can't be a single moment of any of that. And these guys say, yeah, you're not. You play it all together. That's what's called you. That's you conventionally. All these moments strung, and it's true, isn't it? I mean, right from 2 years old to right to where we are now. All those single moments put together, you'd say, that's me. And you go, yeah, that's right. That's conventionally true. So this self of the person is like you said, I was saying before, Ian, about how they all say that the self is imputed to the four or five aggregates, or any of the four or five aggregates, or the five aggregates, right? But the meaning of it differs. They all say the same, the sentence is always the same, but the meaning is different. Because these guys will say, well, who is the self? And they're going to go, your mind. This whole continuum of mental moments, that's you. And that's the you that's going to go out of this life and into the next life. Who else could it be? It can't be your body. So even though the definition is the same, the meaning is different. It's quite different from the middle way consequence school, as you'll see next week. But you see that, they go, no. Is they break it right down again into the parts and go, no, if you're not any one of the parts, you can't be all of them. But convince you from this perspective of this school, does the I perform this function? You have to go, of course it does. It acts. I act. So you exist. This is what's the easiest way? Just imagine your life as a movie. No single frame is you. But the whole story feels like you. So it's these people, the Sartrantic, can say the self is like the movie. It's not real in itself, but it's real enough to matter. And again, look, it's the same thing as the other school we know. There are no self existing independently of those aggregates. There's no self that is those aggregates. That was already established in the beginning. That holds up here, you know. But you can't go back on the reason. The reason's already shown us the truth.
Julia had a question. She said, so mind creates its own type of truth or reality based on perception of self and the world. Basic psychology, yes. One's reality may not be the same as another's. What truth is this?
This is the conventional truth. Again, but it depends, I would say to me, it really depends on which philosophical system you're coming from. So basically, you'd say, from this perspective, it's a conventional truth. And also from the other one too, it's a conventional truth.
I did kind of ask her, like, did you mean from this school or another? And she said, can you explain both? But I think we will be explaining both as the classes go along.
Actually, I will, Julia, there's a couple of slides on just to show you how they come together, both the same and sometimes different. So what's really important in this school is study and debate, because it's so much based on reasoning. And reasoning and how, because it has to do with how the senses work. That's a valid cognition, study about valid cognition. How does consciousness work with its objects? How do subjects and objects work together? So these guys are going to put up a presentation of this, and it's all going to seem reasonable until you get to the mind onion. They're going to shoot it all down. So there's a whole lot of stuff that, it's funny, like the stuff that all seems like, oh yeah, you know, that's how things do, like the last school. And Jan pointed up about, yeah, we know all this. Then the school goes, actually, we don't get it, those objects. Go, oh, heck, I don't get all that. Actually, our mind makes all that up. We go, yeah. So that's what we carry across. So there are these, as you might, in the last school, they base a lot of their understandings on Buddhist texts. So, of course, they're all coming from the Buddha. Right? So then there have been scholars who wrote what the Buddha said and other scholars who go what he meant by what he said. And this is where you get all these big differences in these tenet systems. There's this disagreement about what was meant. And the disagreements come up through reasoning, through taking each of them and subjecting these statements to logic. So the last guys, like I said, on the commentaries, these guys go, no way. We want the actual sutras. We're going to base our stuff on the sutras. So they go right into the sutra, and then they get their great, hundreds of years later, great scholars like Dharmakirti and Dignaga in this particular system, they start getting at this and start arguing, especially the stuff about, next week we'll talk about that. So they have these debates about how the things work. Could they actually work in the way you're saying? No, that's actually the original. It's like what the other scholars have said, how they've interpreted the material. So I'll always go back and go, yep, we're all looking at the same material. The Buddha said this. But then it's like, what's it mean? No books are written by the Buddha. Yeah, what they did was when the Buddha passed away, they grabbed their brightest people to say, okay, what did you hear the Buddha say? And they wrote it down. And then from that, then they look at that and then they ask, what does it mean? Just like we do, right? We watch movies, we read books, what does it mean? They come up with their explanations. Seems all plausible, can be accepted for a while, but somewhere along the line, somebody else will come along and go, I'm sorry, that doesn't make much sense to me. So we all need to look at what the Buddha said and interpret it in a different way. Yes, Debbie?
Jan asks, according to Sautantrika, could we say that the ultimate truth is all phenomena are non-conceptual and ephemeral, but causally effective? Is this correct?
Yep, that's fine, yeah. Yeah, so as a metaphor, it says, studying the Sautantrika method is like learning to distinguish raw ingredients. They're the ultimate truths. from the recipes, they're the conventional truth. So like the flour, the milk, the butter, all that stuff, that's real, performs functions. That's an ultimate truth. The recipe that's made up by us, that's a conventional truth. You'll end up with an actual cake. That's an ultimate truth. It functions. Yeah, so if you find these sort of little metaphors of things, I think it helps us understand and get a bit of grip on what they're talking about. Rosemary. Yeah. That's right. Yeah. So it's not a clock anymore, is it? Doesn't function as well. Well, from this perspective, this is the thing. So it does it if it is, it has to carry the function of the phenomenon.
It becomes a paperweight.
It becomes a different
ultimate truth.
So the most important thing to take away from this is to distinguish objective reality from the mental projections. That's what's really great about this, and it's what's very helpful. So just like Demi said before, you know, we talk about, oh, the sunset is beautiful. Okay, there's a sunset, there's the sun is setting, there is a function being performed. That's ultimately true, but beautiful? That's a projection. Our mind has made it up. That's a conventional. That's a conventional truth. Right? Don't confuse the two. We do. That's what happens. And it's always, if you confuse these two, you get yourself into trouble. And that's what we do. So by viewing all these phenomena as momentary or subject to change, impermanent, the Satanic encourages us to let go of clinging to them. Like releasing frustration when plans change. So this is aligns with accepting impermanence and easing anxiety about loss or failure. So these are good things. This really reduces the emotional reactivity that we have to phenomena. Because like I said, most of it comes about because of that we don't realize we're imputing qualities onto the phenomena. And believing that they're, you know, just over there, and so it's true. Ultimately true. Great easing of anxiety, of course, really simplifies decision making. And it really grounds you in the present too. So the Satrantika really helps us untangle reality from the mental stories we make up. Now, what's interesting here? So the major difference between Vibhashika and the Satrantika in the presentation of what's real, if you can consider like the Vibhashika actually photographs the world. So they're getting photographs. The Satrantika painted. So one's an interpretation and the other's not. It's real. Here it is. That's a simple way of thinking about it. Yeah, the Satanic is painting from memory and feeling and all these sort of things. The others are like, no, there it is, bare reality. It's like that. Each have sort of benefits on either side, but they're not actually, as you can see as we go through, they're not, they're getting it an empty that's easy. The emptiness of the person not being permanent, independent, and singular. And also not being self-existent and autonomous. And that's how the person is not. How does the person exist? Computed to the four or five aggregates. That's it. Then when they start looking at these four or five aggregates, body and mind, asking how these exist, they'll both say they're both impermanent. But they really exist. They have self-sufficiency and substantial existence. They're real. The self is not real like them. Self is made up. It's a conventionality. But these things are real. So like, you know, we behave that way, don't we? Got a real body. My thoughts are real. There's a real world out there. And they go, yeah, we'll start right there. That's like going to primary school. That's how we're taught. And to act that way. What's not real is a real me. And that's probably the simplest way to put this. And then you look at going, okay, how do I behave when I think I am a real me? Yeah, we all know. Right? How different might it be if we thought, gee, I just made up, I just made myself up. we might behave very differently. Because we actually have, that's what we've done. And that's enough. That's all it takes. And we're fine, we're away. Right? That's how we exist. And then they say, if you misapprehend, if you give ultimate existence to this made up I, well, you're going to get in trouble. That's what happens. And if you also think, oh, just because I'm, you know, although you wouldn't go that far, no, you just be, no, it's real. The world is real. And then we think, I am too. No, let's have a look at that. You're not as real as the world, basically. From these two schools, that's what they're saying. We've got to alter our behavior. So we're right on 12. I'll do this last meditation because it won't take long, and then we'll wrap up. Okay, so just sit straight, relax your shoulders and close your eyes. And let your body breathe itself. So the insights of this school called Sautrantika or Sutra, their insights have to do with impermanence and perception. The philosophy teaches that reality unfolds moment by moment. Knowing this creates an altruistic motivation to sharpen and deepen your clarity and connection to this life's fleeting beauty. So if you can imagine your mind to be a lens, and it's focusing on the dance between perception and reality. This school teaches that only momentary phenomena, like sparks, flash, are real. All else is mental labeling. Clinging to illusions of permanence creates suffering. It's like trying to grab the reflection of a river. And reality flows like a movie reel. Each frame exists only to vanish. Yet together, they craft a story. So what object in your life feels solid and real? The even phenomena as solid as mountains shift and change grain by grain. Underlying everything is change. So how does language shape what we perceive? Where do you conflate idea and experience? Here's an experiment. Next time we touch the bark of a tree, notice the gap between touching the bark and thinking tree. One is direct, the other is a story. The thoughts are maps, they're not the terrain. Thinking they're otherwise, we'd be like mistaking the menu's description for the meal itself. And breathe in deeply through your nostrils. Exhale. Remember here, but in this system, and this is what you can easily do, like I say, whatever you touch, like for this system, that's real. What you think right after that, that's what you made up. That's the conventional truth. What's your takeaway? Well, this is what you could do. Don't cling to the objects of your senses, because even though you touch them, remember they're impermanent. They're changing right under, even though it doesn't seem like it, they are. They're not stable. They're real, but they're not stable. So to think that they are stable, you're unchanging, that's a mistake. And then to think that the word you use to describe it is the thing, that's another mistake. So both of those things are what we call clinging or grasping. One is grasping at permanence, the other is grasping at your idea of it as being it. Different phenomenon. So basically, recollect change or impermanence as often as you can, while at the same time being kind. Even though nothing is stable, everything is changing, just like us. So kindness is necessary, it works, it helps. Next week, we're going to look at two other systems. They're, again, very different than what we just saw. Chittamana is like completely mental. They go the other way. They kind of always that thing with what you're talking about. It's just all mental. The next one goes, well, it's not. Just like, I know, you go, oh, man. And yet each one, the view is becoming more and more subtle until you finally end up like in the middle way. At least understanding it. I mean, it doesn't mean to say get it right away, but you do know there are these different ways of thinking. It's just like going to school. You learn different subjects. You learn different depths about it. It's the same here. So, thank you, those online. Thank you, those who are here. Let's dedicate our the merit that we've put into thinking, reflecting, contemplating, meditating. Due to the merit of these virtuous actions, may I quickly attain the state of a Guru Buddha and lead all living beings, without exception, into that enlightened state. May the supreme jewel, Bodhicitta, not yet born, arise and grow. May that born have no decline, but increase forevermore. And as long as space remains, as long as sentient beings remain, may I too remain to dispel the sorrows of the world. Hearing for His Holiness, the Dalai Lama. The wish-granting, wish-fulfilling jewel, source of every single benefit and happiness in this world. To the incomparably kind Tenzin Gyatso, I beseech, may all your holy wishes be spontaneously fulfilled. Finally, for Rinpoche's swift return. In holding and spreading the Buddha's precious and complete teachings through explanation and practice, you wore the armor of patience and is never discouraged. Incomparable, Venerable Guru, to you I make this request.